Coming up on Tech News Today, CCleaner, that's the popular antivirus software, gets infected and distributed. Intel and Waymo take their partnership to the next level. Google releases Tez to the Indian market for cashless payments. And why are ad networks allowing for racist ad campaigns? All that and more with Ron Richards coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1855, recorded Monday, September 18th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/TNT and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell. I know that Megan Maroney is passionate about technology. She's just not here today. She's not even taking a day off. I think she's at the TechCrunch Disrupt conference going on in San Francisco. So she's there in her place. I have in this monitor behind me, Mr. Ron Richards, and the week of Ron. How's it going, Ron?
Thanks. Good to be here. I'm disrupting tech news today. That's what I'm disrupting. While Megan is disrupting TechCrunch,
yes,
I'm disrupting Jason.
Well, I'm always happy for you to disrupt TNT in Megan's absence. Now, when I say week of Ron, I don't mean that Ron's going to be on TNT all week. Nope. However, we've got
you're going to have to stay dialed in to Twit.
Yeah.
Because the week of Ron is spanning multiple shows.
Exactly. It's like a kaleidoscope of Ron all over a number of Twitch shows throughout the week, which I'm stoked about because I get to do all of them with you.
I will be back here tomorrow for All About Android like we are every Tuesday. And then I will also be joining you on Wednesday for This Week in Google, which is funny because we didn't plan this that way. We're just like a couple weeks ago, hey, you want to go on Twitch? Great. Jason's hosting. Cool. And then, hey, do you want to go on TNT? Great. Sure. And then it's like, oh, wow, 3 days in a row. But Jason, this is our time together.
Yes.
So I'm good.
This is how we hang out now because you don't live in the Bay Area anymore and haven't for a while.
Miss you.
So this is, this is like the most number of hours in a single week we'll have hanging out. So I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
Let's get it started here. We have some top stories to discuss today. CCleaner, but it's CCleaner for Windows, which is a popular antivirus and security app created by and hosted on Avast Software's site, was found to be tainted with a backdoor and served to millions of its users as an official update between August 15th and September 12th of this year. Quite a run there. Cisco Talos researchers discovered the malicious activity within the supposedly legitimate software. The malware was found to have sent detailed information about the infected computer to a server, including a fail-safe system called the domain generation algorithm that would still transmit the stolen data in the event that the hacker's servers went down. That seems to point to a deeper level of sophistication in the hack. But I think the big question, and I feel like this is not the first time that we've heard of this sort of thing happening, where a official file is served up on an official web page, like the product's web page, you just kind of automatically as a user trust that it's coming from the source, therefore it's cleared and it's good. In this case, that was absolutely not true. They were serving up for almost a month a version of their antivirus software, no less, that had this malware creating a backdoor into people's computers and transmitting data behind the scenes. Not so good.
It's downright chilling. That's what it is, because it's the kind of thing, like, if you can't trust the people making the antivirus software, who can you trust?
So,
yeah. So it's a bit disconcerting. I think the combination when you hear a story about antivirus being hacked and the words deeper level of sophistication in the hack and official source, these are the times where you need to take a step back and Avast has got to look at all of their processes and identify how this happened. Well, I'm sure they're doing that. They're doing all the steps that they can to do it. But it just seems like if there's a hole for a sophisticated hack like this to get in, what do we not know about yet?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my question.
Yeah. I mean, they're, I guess as far as how they end up bringing their updates to the site, they cryptographically sign their installations specifically to prevent this, so that, you know, by the time it appears on the site, it's got that cryptographic protection in it, so that if it's changed after the fact downstream, that goes counter to the identification that they have from the official file, and it's easy to decipher. This means that the hackers somehow got this update in there prior to that approval process. And I think that's going to be a very interesting kind of breadcrumb trail to follow, if there is anything to follow. It makes you wonder, you know, are they indoors?
Well, yeah, I was gonna say I don't want to get too Hollywood on it, right. But sounds like an inside job, guys. It sounds like somebody's disgruntled and was like, okay, yeah, I'll do that, and hopefully they find the person and can shut it down. But yeah, ooh, this could be a great movie.
Yeah. Not so good when you're a security company and this happens to your security product. But Piriform, who owns Avast, says that the rogue server and other potential servers that were active here are seized from hacker control. They claim that they have disarmed the threat as a result. So kind of downplaying it a little bit, like, hey, you know, it's not a big deal. We took care of it. Hey, continue on. And, you know, obviously the version that they're serving up right now, as far as I know, is fixed. You know, this is all patched and there's nothing to see here. Move along.
Cross your fingers.
But yeah, it just adds another layer of confusion to where you get official updates, because we say it all the time on All About Android, right? Don't get your apps from anywhere unofficial. Get it from the Play Store. In this case, this is coming directly from the software creator, you know, served up on their site. And if you can't trust that, what can you trust? That's all I have.
Man, I'm not going to sleep well tonight.
I know. I'm sorry. You're going to lose sleep. Then you're going to be all tired on All About Android tomorrow. Yeah. I apologize in advance for that, Ron. Autonomous vehicles require the sharpest computers in order to compute the 4 terabytes of data per hour that's generated to understand its surroundings and navigate accordingly. And Intel has announced that it would be collaborating with Alphabet's Waymo division to be the brains that power its autonomous driving systems. Currently, Waymo has Intel-based computing inside the company's fleet of Chrysler Pacifica minivans, and Intel says it hopes to deliver on improved power and efficiency. The goal, of course, is to get Waymo's vehicles to level 4 and 5 autonomy in all types of real-world settings. So this is kind of a further development of the Waymo-Intel relationship. Intel has a lot going on right now in autonomous vehicle technology. It's kind of been a different direction for them, but it seems to be paying off.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to see how Intel can leverage their long, long, long legacy of chip making and processor making and stuff like that, and getting them in devices like autonomous cars, drones, you know, like this kind of next generation, you know, kind of hardware that is going to be driven by processing. They want to be the chip to do that. You know, computers are almost passe now. It's computers inside of things. And so it makes sense that Intel would do it. I think this is a big deal and changes who you're going to bet on in the autonomous car game, potentially. I think it shows that Waymo is making really interesting decisions that can't be predicted in this way. Like, I didn't think Waymo would partner, you know, Google, and maybe because it's Alphabet, not Google, but generally these kind of deep kind of partnerships aren't the way they go, right? Mm-hmm. So I was surprised.
Yeah, well, especially because Waymo they're building so much of the components inside their autonomous vehicles by themselves. Yep. And Sam Abu El-Samid, frequent guest on this show, from Navigant Researcher, writing for Forbes, he says that this announcement to him was surprising because everybody just kind of believed that Waymo was going to go it alone as far as, you know, designing custom designed chips. They have their tensor processing units, the TPUs, and those, you know, are, you know, critically revolve around artificial intelligence and machine learning, and that, you know, would make a lot of sense bringing that into the vehicle. But it sounds like instead they're kind of focusing on Intel and working with Intel early on so that they can embed this technology from the point of design, instead of tacking it on later at some point or whatever. It's there, you know, Intel is now an early part of that whole development process with this deal.
Yeah, I think it could yield some really great results. I mean, I think Intel's really been investing in this, you know, in this space, and you know, partnering with somebody like Waymo and seeing what their chips can do with their devices. It just seemed very interesting.
So. Yeah, yeah, and I mean, Intel's been making a lot of moves lately. They recently acquired Mobileye, that completed in June, and that's seen Intel, you know, kind of moving into offering or working on its own fleet of self-driving cars. They're going to be testing that in the U.S., in Europe, in Israel later this year. So this is a good little side bet for Intel. It's probably more than just a side bet, but at this point, it's been a good kind of way for them to focus and kind of make sure that they move on from their legacy business into something that's really developing and moving and. That's working. Yeah. Google officially unveiled Tez, which is not a Pez dispenser. It's a mobile payments wallet for India that lets users sync their bank accounts to their phones for in-store purchases, online purchases, and P2P transfers. The app uses audio QR, which is a way of transmitting ultrasonic sounds for the exchange, something that we've seen in things like Chromecast uses this for guest pairing as one example. It's not a traditional mobile wallet that keeps stored money at the ready for making payments. Instead, it's about linking the accounts that someone would already have to their phone so that they have easy access to that. And it's launching in India today on iOS and Android, probably going to come to other Asian markets at some point. I guess something that I haven't been too familiar with about the Indian market, apparently the money market is super fragmented and they've been very cash focused up until now. A lot of other, you know, markets around the world have really shifted, you know, the U.S. prime example, really shifted a lot to kind of credit, supporting credit cards. You've got support for credit cards all over the country in the U.S. and have for long, 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 long time. Same for Europe, same for a lot of other countries. India has been very focused on cash, but the country has been kind of forced to change because times have changed. Everything's a lot more digital nowadays. And so the government created something called the Unified Payments Interface, UPI. And this is kind of built to support that setup.
Yeah, and I think that you know, Google definitely understands what the emerging markets in India as well as in Asia, Southeast Asia, can bring as far as user adoption. So if this is early days in using that unified payments interface, and Google can get a foothold and get everyone using Tez, then that's, you know, that's a user base that they will want. I'm fascinated by this. Look at all those cash, by the way, in that video we're seeing of somebody buying something in India. That's like mobster level cash.
Wow. I know, right?
I'm fascinated by, you can probably guess, Jason, the use of audio QR.
Yeah.
Which you know, which we like you mentioned, we've seen audio QR with Chromecast, with other devices, but I've never seen audio QR in a secure financial application, application. I think that's really like, wow, I want to see this work in the wild, because if audio QR is maturing to the point where they trust it with secure financial transactions, then wow, that could blow NFC and Bluetooth LE out of the water.
Yeah, especially because like NFC, I feel like a few years ago, NFC was all the hotness. Now it's not even a spec. I mean, when we feature phones at all about Android, you know, rarely do we actually mention whether it has NFC or not, which I'm not sure why, because there are still things that use it plenty of times. But I think in markets like India and China, where a lot of the devices are kind of low mid tier, NFC would be one of those, you know, one of those technologies that you would cut in order to make that price point. And audio QR, AQR, doesn't require an extra NFC chip to be installed on these devices, and they don't have that chip there. Instead, it just, you know, has the ability to blast out this little tone that the human ear can't hear, but the other phone can. So it kind of works similar to NFC for establishing that connection. I don't know if necessarily the money transfers over that QR. I think that's more like the pairing mechanism, right?
Sure. Yeah. No. It's saying this is the person who is paying and whatever. But it's a secure it's a transaction. You know, so there's got to be a level of security. So I really got to wonder, you know, with these ultrasonic sounds that are being out there, will there be spoofing devices or some way to, you know, interpret it or get? I'm really curious how this works under the hood, basically. You know, I'm sure it's secure. They're not going to roll it out if it's not secure. And it seems like they have the backing of the Indian government. But I mean, it is a new way to transfer data. and a financial application. That's crazy. So, I mean, that's cool. I'm excited to see it. I just, speaking of NFC, I just finally set up the NFC tapless or whatever, frictionless with Bank of America for their ATMs.
Now
all I do is I tap my phone to the ATM and it gives me a screen to ask for my PIN number. I never take the card out of my pocket, which is another mind-blowing thing of what NFC can do. Now imagine if I didn't even have to take my phone out of the pocket. It knew I was near an ATM and it used audio QR and then just say, Ron, here's your, enter your PIN. That could be really interesting.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I just, and then when you go to a store and you're using Android Pay, that has nothing to do with NFC, right?
This thing I was using for Bank of America actually is leveraging Android Pay. So what's happening is that it's using Android Pay to access my debit card to say, this is the card that would be going into the ATM if they were sliding it in. And then it asked me for my PIN number and then go off to the races.
Yeah.
So it still needs Android Pay to work. It's just not, that's the conduit to the card.
Right. Yeah. As far as Tez is concerned, no fee for the payments or the transactions. So basically, at least at this point, Google isn't making any money off of it, or at least not in any way that, you know, surfaces on the little receipt that you get when you do some sort of a transaction. I'm sure that'll change at some point, because why do you do this if you can't make a little money off of it eventually? Samsung is rolling out an update to Samsung Galaxy S8, S8 Plus, and Note 8 owners that adds a toggle to the settings to determine what happens when the Bixby button is pressed. This means that if you've been by accident bumping that button and bemoaning the Bixby breakthrough, declare Bixby bankruptcy by disabling the Bixby button instead. Sorry.
Wow. I'm impressed.
I had a little too much time on my hands. Of course, the settings only allow you to turn it off or to turn it on. So there is no official way to put that button to some other use if you wanted to. Perhaps that's coming in a future update. But it's like the setting is, when you push this button, does it summon Bixby or does it do absolutely nothing? I feel like the next step is, just give us some open, control over what it actually does. That would be just a little bit better.
So it's fascinating. You're right that it's basically disabling a physical button on the device.
Yeah.
Right, and making it do nothing. But the if you're speculating that an update would allow you to assign an action to it, wouldn't that just be the death knell for Bixby? I mean, Bixby's getting mixed reviews as it is. If you can turn it off and then assign that button to do something else, why would you ever use Bixby then?
Well, I mean, arguably what you're saying is true with the fact that they're letting you turn it off, because then everybody's just going to turn it off. And I mean, that doesn't mean that Bixby is off of your device. It doesn't mean that Bixby goes away. All that means is that the Bixby voice aspect of Bixby isn't triggered by that button. You can still get to Bixby by swiping left, I think it is, from the home screen. You have the whole Bixby menu or whatever to get to. So.
But I just wonder, is this in response to user feedback? Do people not like that button and accidentally hitting it, causing Bixby to wake up? And also, like, I'm wondering, what is the motivation for this change? And if it is a change in leading to an update, why not just wait for that update?
Burke believes something.
Burke
has thoughts. He thinks that Samsung is just stalling.
Stalling for what?
What, Burke? He a nice little shrug there.
Burke is stalling.
For something. Yes. For something.
See.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have seen people complaining, reviewers and whatnot. I certainly had it happen a couple of times where that button, it's a button on the side that when it presses, it does something like pulls up a voice entry thing. And sometimes that can happen seemingly at random, but it's because you bumped into it and maybe you just don't want it to do that anymore.
Is this leading the way for Google Assistant to come to Samsung devices in a more integrated fashion?
I don't know.
And would that cut Bixby off at the knees?
Well, I'm sure a lot of the people complaining about Bixby to begin with would probably reassign that button to Assistant.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's by and large, like, Samsung users, there's so many of them. Like, I don't know how many of the actual users really care that much. You know, it just ends up being a button they don't press.
Or how much feedback does it take for Samsung to react to and make a change like this? That's what I think is more like, what is the motivation for this change? Anyway, so
Yeah.
Tune in tomorrow at All About Android, and we'll talk more about the Bixby button.
That's right. We'll see if we can string more B words together and blow your mind. Coming up, more ad networks are letting people target racist terms. But first, let's take a minute to thank Ring Video Doorbell. They're the sponsor of this episode. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. And today, over a million people use the awesome Ring Video Doorbell to help protect their homes. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. And that's why they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's Video Doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. With high-definition video and two-way audio, it lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm remotely right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what that bump actually is. Whether you're home or whether you're away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home. It's all transmitted over the internet, so you can tune in wherever you happen to be. Ring Floodlight Cams offer the ultimate in home security with high visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. It's also named the Wall Street Journal's Best of CES 2017. You can monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security Kit. All kits include a Ring Video Doorbell, and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. Connect your Ring Video Doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs also, and you get added convenience, monitoring, and security. It's like the whole security kit. With Ring, you're always home. Save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/TNT. That's ring.com/TNT. And we thank Ring for their support of Tech News Today. Last Thursday, Megan and I discussed ProPublica's discovery that racist categories could be targeted for ads on Facebook. And then shortly after, we started to hear that the same could be done on other advertising networks. So joining us to talk about the developments is Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed. Welcome back, Alex.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. So you wrote last week, tail end, I think last Friday, about Google's own problems when it comes to offering racist advertising keywords for those looking to run their ad campaigns against. Tell us exactly what BuzzFeed found.
Well, we wanted to do the experiment that ProPublica did with Facebook, but just run it on Google. And it turns out that Google was probably even more shocking than the ad categories that showed up on Facebook. So what I did was type in the same keywords that ProPublica, or very similar terms that ProPublica typed in to Google's keyword tool, which if you scroll down a bit in the story, there's an embedded image. There it is right there. So I typed in things like, you know, Jews ruin everything or white people ruin. And the keyword tool actually suggested a number of other racist and bigoted terms for us to run against. So you see white people ruin there. And they suggested we run an ad to, targeted to black people ruin neighborhoods. I typed in Jews ruin everything, and then it went through every, you know, different negative stereotype about Jews, whether it's controlling the banks or the media. Mm-hmm. And then based off of these keywords, I built an ad campaign, broke it into two different ad groups. And then we just set the campaign live and tried to figure out whether or not Google would serve those ads. So we served 17 ads, and I checked in with Google and said, what's going on here? The campaign immediately shut down. Almost every single keyword was disapproved except for one. I think it was black people destroy everything, continued to run live after our campaign was brought to the attention of Google. Now, Google will tell you, just because the keyword is enabled inside its ad platform doesn't mean it's necessarily running. So we did see some of these terms. I did exact match for every single one of them, which means that unless people typed in, the ads would only target to people typing in that exact term. So maybe people didn't type in the term, or maybe Google decided not to run them. But the bottom line is Google helped us basically create these campaigns, came up with extra ideas, and then the campaign went live and served ads.
So those terms end up in the system somehow. What is the process that brings that terminology into this ad campaign to be marketed against in the first place? How does it end up there?
From my understanding, the Google keyword suggestion tool works by searching both your landing page, so the page that you're sending visitors to, and then similar searches. So we sent people to the ProPublica article because the options, so in order to run a campaign on Google, you need everything to line up. You need the keyword, the ad copy, and the landing page to all have similar terms on them to be, you know, linked. So you can't run an ad for Britney Spears and then send them people to the Little Mermaid page. It has to be, you know, Britney Spears all the way through. So we thought instead of creating our own racist website or sending people to Stormfront, we would just send people to the ProPublica story, which had all the terms in there because they had reported on them and would then give us a high quality score.
Right. Now, when it comes time or when it comes to targeting these specific searches, are there a lot of ad campaigns? Like, is there any visibility to know how many ad campaigns are actually targeting them also? Or is it, I'm assuming the number is pretty low, but I mean, is there any way of knowing that for sure?
We don't have any way of knowing that for sure. And it's actually a good question that came up in the wake of my story and the ProPublica story, which is, okay, so you can target this stuff, but is anyone actually doing this? And I think that, you know, we had maybe a year ago, this wouldn't have been a big issue. No one really thought anyone was going to, you know, target things like how to burn Jews. But a lot has changed in the recent past. And I think especially after Charlottesville, people are really, they're starting to pay attention to stuff a lot more. And the idea that someone might run an ad targeted these keywords has gone from preposterous to something we should think about. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to think about it. So I can tell you, you know, we don't know the number of ad campaigns run towards it, but you can definitely see the number of organic searches that happen, or at least get a sense from Google's keyword tool. And I think in that screenshot we rolled over before, we saw that people actually are searching these terms.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my question around this is, and I'm gonna preface this with, do not support anything on the racist side of things, or you know, all that sort of stuff. I'd be clear about that. But the question I'm curious about is that, you know, both Google and Facebook have created these tools that are largely non-people driven. You know, they're algorithmic driven, they're machine driven, and they're made to, you know, they're doing what, you know, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. And, you know, and what is the expectation now that this has kind of been uncovered for Google and Facebook to make changes when really, like, if I just wanted to sell plaid shirts to people who thought this way, where's the responsibility on Google or Facebook lie? Is it in the ad content or the targeting or in the end result ad? I mean, really, like, now that this information is out there, what can we do with it?
That's a really good question. I think I want to stop short of saying what Google and Facebook should do, but I'll tell you something. Fair. Both of those companies did take action. So Facebook said they've eliminated the categories. Google said they're going to pause the keyword tool suggestions in the categories that I typed in. I think maybe a few more as they reevaluate this tool. So I think that, you know, both Google and Facebook, by their actions, have admitted that something wasn't right on their platform. And I don't know. I think that makes sense to me. You know, they're going to have to figure out exactly the way to do. There's always a balance here because you don't want, you know, someone made a point that the more that these platforms act, the more they're exercising that power that everybody is worried about, that Google and Facebook have become so powerful, and when do they use it? But I do think that, like, I'm not going to argue against them taking out, like, stereotypical bigoted and racial terms from their keyword suggestion tool. It doesn't seem like a bad thing to me.
Agreed. Totally. It makes me think back years and years and years ago when I actually published my own magazine. You know, I had advertisers, and I drew a line in the sand saying I will not run any ads for alcohol or cigarettes or any, you know, kind of sinful like kind of ads. And that's the discretion of the publisher to set guidelines around what they will advertise or won't advertise. So I think it's within their right. They're totally within their rights to be able to say that that's not okay for our platform.
Right. And that makes total sense. And advertisers, you know, they've been very vocal recently about the type of content they want their ads running on and the type of platforms they want their ads running on. So it's a business imperative for these two companies to get this right, as well as a moral imperative.
Yeah, that's, I mean, one of the questions that I've had as this has kind of been bubbling up is, like, the ad network business is so, I mean, it's so complex, and there's a lot of things that we've definitely learned of in the past year, but I think that people have known for a long time that's, you know, somewhat manipulative, right? They're basically trading in people's data, and sometimes that can be a very dangerous thing. So I mean, part of me feels a little cynical in the sense that I feel like this is just kind of part and parcel of what they've done for a long time. It's just now times have changed a little bit and people are more focused on it, or maybe people are just now noticing. But do you think this kind of thing has been happening for a long time? We just haven't noticed. It's been happening under the radar.
So before I reported on social media, I used to report on ad tech, and the job of an ad tech reporter a few years ago and still today, a good chunk of the time that you spend is pointing out problems in the digital ad industry. So there's been problems with fraud. There's been problems with viewability. There's been problems with brand safety. And there's probably 100 others that I can list, but we probably, you know, we don't have the time for that. But there's definitely major, major issues in the digital ad industry. And one of the questions that we dealt with is like, well, how big are these problems and how do you contextualize them? And I think one of the things people need to realize is that it's still early. Like, these industries are young industries, 15, 20 years. I mean, Facebook, you know, is only a little over a decade old. Mm-hmm. So in the early going, you're always going to have messy things that are going to happen, and then you adjust to them. And so I think that, like, this is part of what we're seeing. We're seeing digital ad industry and social companies and Google all are in the process of trying to figure out how to shape their platforms in a way that that will carry on for many, many years from now. Like, we're in the digital age. So these are the platforms we're going to be living on for a long time. And, you know, we're going to have to find systems that work. I mean, the companies will have to find systems that work. The advertisers will have to find systems that work. And the reporters will have to keep a close eye on what goes on. So this is part of the early growing pains that, you know, it may seem kind of crazy to look at it as an early stage issue because these platforms are already so dominant, but they're still young and they're still figuring it out. And we're going to be living with them for many decades going forward. So everybody right now gets the front seat to the formation of the longstanding policies that will inevitably take place.
Yeah, what you're talking about is made even worse in the fact that sometimes a week feels like a year in this day and age. So,
this yes. year for sure. Yeah.
Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed.com. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thanks so much for having me. Always great chatting with you guys.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Alex. Good night.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and TNT's fan of the day. We have one. It's Rob Wilkinson. He actually sent us this picture. He says, this is, quote, me and my Bitmoji watching tech news today. Everybody's trying to outdo everybody else. His Bitmoji, of course, is by a water cooler.
you know, I like that.
Tech news today, so it's a lot of what we talk about. It's water cooler stuff. It's good by the water cooler, even for Bitmojis.
I like that his back is to the Bitmoji camera. Like, he's watching the show. Like, it's good. It's good blocking. It's good positioning.
I know. It was really well done. I wonder if this is one of those animated Bitmojis that you get from Snapchat. Did you see that the other day?
I did. Yeah, I did. Yep. I haven't got a chance to play with it, but I saw that.
It must be the AR Bitmoji. Yeah. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. You can post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. Never hurts to even email it in because sometimes I don't check them all the time. So email it, sure. TNT@twit.tv. We get some that way as well. Finally, you've had, maybe not you, Ron, but some of you have had the Nintendo Switch since it came out, and you played it so much you practically know it inside and out, except that you don't, because apparently buried deep inside the console code is an NES emulator wrapped around something called FLOG, which, if you swap those letters backwards, turns into golf. And a hacker by the name of Yellow S8 says it's been part of the firmware since version 1.0. The hacker didn't share how he or she got the code to run, but he shared screenshots that show the classic 1984 NES golf simulator called Golf running on the Switch, complete with Joy-Con motion controller support. So we're talking, I'm guessing anyways, this is the NES golf game, but with like Wii-like controls with the motion controller, which I think would be cool because I loved that game. I don't know. Did you ever play that game?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Back in the mid-80s, we played every game we could get our hands on. I remember playing this game. That golf game was great. This is very funny. It doesn't surprise me because isn't the Switch just basically an NVIDIA Android tablet?
News to me, is it? Burke's shaking his head, Burke knows everything.
Pretty sure that the whole architecture that the Switch is built on is basically, I mean, it's a very, very specific and Nintendo edited, all that sort of stuff, but it's at its core level as Android, so the fact that it could run an NES emulator is not a surprise to me at all, so...
Interesting. Yeah, I think Eurogamer reported that at the end of last year. I missed this one.
Very cool.
Oh, that's interesting. And I mean, Nintendo has made mention. I think initially, wasn't the Switch supposed to launch with some sort of virtual console support? And then they said, it's not going to happen at launch, but it's coming at some point, and we still kind of don't have that. So apparently, or maybe, this is kind of part of that compatibility underneath. But you've got an awesome NES golf game just hanging out in there, not being played. And there's no real way to play it. Like, this hacker was able to activate it, not through any easy means, from what I understand. So maybe Nintendo will get the nice feeling and let everybody have access to that at some point. I don't know. I hope so.
According for you nerds out there, and this is just on Wikipedia, but according to the Nintendo Switch system software, it says that Nintendo Switch is using code from FreeBSD kernel, similar to PlayStation 4, and that several components from Android are present in the operating system, such as the Stage Fright multimedia framework and rendering of web content via WebKit. So there you go.
Okay.
The more you know.
Do, 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 do. And that is why we have Mr. Ron Richards on the show when we can. Ron, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk some tech news that isn't Android related.
It was a blast. I love talking about tech other than Android. I love talking about Android too. And yeah. If you like Android, you should check me out along with Jason and Florence Ion every Tuesday on Twitter around 5:30 Pacific time. And we go for a good couple hours talking Android, and it's always a blast.
Yeah.
But you can also check out my other podcast over at ifanboy.com, where I'm talking about comic books every week and comic book TV shows and movies and all that fun stuff. And then I also did a podcast about Twin Peaks with Tom Merritt over at damnfinepodcast.com. And I might have a new podcast coming out this month. So follow me on Twitter at RonXO to find the details about that one when it hits.
Why are you so prolific, Ron?
So prolific because I'm afraid of having nothing to do.
I hear you. I understand that. Although, man, lately I haven't had any time to have nothing to do. But when I do, I get bored. So I know that feeling. Cool. Ron, hey, why don't we do this again tomorrow on All About Android?
I'll be here.
Okay, cool. Thanks for joining me tonight, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW and find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV. Don't forget, of course, to subscribe to the show. You can find it at twit.tv/TNT, and you can subscribe for yourself or even, you know, all the people that you know. Spread the love. Spread the TNT love. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director and editor, Kevin. Thanks to Burke for helping in the studio. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody. Awkward hand, high five time.
And bam.
There we go. That worked.
Yeah.